Show. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, you're going to be hearing from the author of a wonderful new novel for young adult readers called The Library of Broken Worlds. But first, we're going to be sharing with you an intriguing conversation that was actually recorded and initially broadcast 20 years ago, back in 2003, with one of the authors of a book called The Anger Advantage, which examines the important place of anger in our lives and how many women, even in 21st century America, are raised to believe that it is somehow wrong for them to be angry. This book takes aim at that misunderstanding. Here's that conversation, again, recorded and initially broadcast back in 2003. Our topic today on The Morning Show is anger, and specifically how anger can be of benefit to women. And we are also going to talk about how anger has in some ways been sort of a suppressed emotion for many women, taught as young girls that to be angry is an unfeminine, unattractive trait that needs to be avoided at all costs. And, of course, there's all sorts of evidence to the contrary. And the topic is a fascinating one, which has been explored by three women, Deborah Cox, Sally Stabb, and our guest today, Karen Bruckner, who have co-written a fascinating book entitled The Anger Advantage, The Surprising Benefits of Anger and How It Can Change a Woman's Life. This is published by Broadway Books, and we have Karen Bruckner with us for a few minutes to talk about it. Karen Bruckner, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I think right off the bat, the story of how this study came about with the three of you in collaboration is in itself worth discussing. Tell us about the three of you, your connection with one another, and your collective work on this topic of anger among women.
Sure. We actually started independently, but we were all together at the same university, Texas Women's University, in Denton, Texas. And there were actually several students who were working on theses and dissertations projects at the time that had something to do with some aspect of anger. And Sally Stabb is a professor there. She was the first one to pull together this thread of commonality between all of our research topics and put together a presentation, a roundtable presentation at a national convention back in the mid-90s. And so when we all came together and presented together, that's when we really started to talk with each other. And we were also at the time approached by an editor for our first book who said, you know, we are really interested in an academic book on this topic. And so several of us started out together thinking about writing on that book, and it ended up with just Sally and Deborah and myself. And so we really forged a research relationship and a collaboration and also a friendship over the years, and have continued to be, just as you said, it's a fascinating topic for us. We continue to be really interested in it. It's really relevant to our personal lives for each of the three of us and the lives of our clients and friends and family. So it's one of those things that I've developed a passion for.
You talk in the introduction of the book about all three of you had essentially the same experience growing up of being told that girls should not be angry. It was the one emotion
people did not want to see in women. And I think one of the points you're making is that the three of you did not have identical childhoods, identical backgrounds by any means, but all three of you experienced this.
That's very true. That's very true. We did, and it was a striking realization in the beginning of our research. And since then, in talking to women, you know, sometimes as part of our formal studies that we've done, and sometimes just anecdotally, we would get together and meet certain places, and we'd be out eating dinner in a restaurant, or we'd be at a bed and breakfast. And a conversation would start with the people that were waiting on us or were staying with us. And whenever we brought up the topic of what our book was about, invariably women would say, "Oh, you should talk to me. I can tell you some stories about anger." And there just seems to be a real common experience, even outside the three of us, obviously.
Your study has been called the Women's Anger Project, and I liked how you, in talking about that and the writing of the book, you called it at one point the hammering process. Which I thought was a real interesting choice of words. And you say the hammering process was long and complicated. And I suppose partly because you're tackling here an extremely broad, potentially very complex topic amongst essentially all women who, of course, are all unique individuals.
Right, and it is. It's extremely complex. One of the challenges in writing this book has to resist the tendency or the temptation to make it a black and white issue, just to make it simple enough to be, you know, enjoyable to read, because it is very complex. There's all kinds of personality characteristics and cultural characteristics and age and gender differences that play into it. And really, we think of this book as a snapshot of where we're at in our journey in the research, and I think that reflects the state of research as a whole in the field of psychology on anger, whereas a couple of decades ago, the research tended to be a lot more black and white. Do you hold your anger in or do you let it out, you know, one or the other? And is it good to do one or is it good, or is it bad? And really, now the research is a lot more sophisticated and complex, so that we're looking at shades of gray. Mm. You know, for some people, at some times, it is more helpful to hold their anger in, and at other times to let it out. And that's kind of why we organized the book the way that we did, because we have chapters on anger at work, anger in the family, anger in a love relationship, in friendship, and that's because we found that in listening to women, women do make different choices in different contexts. And so we really wanted to reflect the complexity in how we organize the material.
One of the things I want to talk about specifically is the fact that you have written this book for women. Mm-hmm. And so you are, of course, proceeding from the assumption that to a significant degree, men and women express anger, experience anger in profoundly different ways. One of the questions I want to ask you is, do you believe that that difference, let's grant that it exists to some extent, do you believe that that dichotomy is as sharply contrasted today as, for instance, it was 30 years ago? I ask the question because I think some people would suggest that there is not quite the drastic divergence between genders maybe now that there was a generation ago.
Right. I think I would agree that there isn't. That's very true. And I think in just some of the materials that I've read, some of the things that I've read lately that have not been so much academic but more in the popular press, that point has been made that there's a sense that women are getting angrier. And I'm not sure if that's the case or as maybe as you suggest, that women are feeling more free to be open with their anger than they have in the past. And it was still interesting for us to find the way that we do much of our research is to try to hear women's stories and ask them to speak about their experience in their own voice. And so it's really interesting to still hear how much of the time women feel that it's important not to be open and free with their anger.
So this may be, because I'm thinking, for instance, once upon a time, so many boys were told, never to cry or don't play the flute or whatever it might be. And it really, some of those sort of stereotypes are, it seems to me anyway, are beginning to fall away.
Yes, thankfully.
Thankfully so. But you are suggesting maybe that this may be one of those areas in which that dichotomy is still very much in place.
Well, here's what I see. I think anger in itself has a really bad reputation. For men and women, it's considered, to be in a negative light. And I think that's because in our culture we have not developed a positive model for how to deal with your anger. If you think about anger as an emotion, a natural emotion that occurs in the course of everyday living, just like happiness and sadness and all our other feelings, and it's inevitable, it's going to come up, but yet it is one of those emotions because it is uncomfortable to feel angry. And also because it is so closely associated with aggression, it's just an emotion that has a bad reputation is what I call it. And even men are taught to be careful with their anger. It's just that men in very significant ways have more permission to be aggressive than women do. And we see that in the images that you see in the media, on TV and in the movies and the whole, as macho image, which of course has that whole tendency to socialize boys that way, has changed over the last couple of decades, but it's still very much there.
You, in the course of this book, surveyed over 1,000 women. One of the things that occurs to me is that, for one, to do a study of something like this, which is by its very nature a very comprehensive sort of thing, it surely is of utmost importance that those 1,000-plus women somehow represent a broad swath of our society. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can give us some sense of the care with which you and your colleagues took to ensure that you were not just speaking to, for instance, other professional women of your own age and economic class and that sort of thing. How broad a span of experience are we talking about in these 1,000 or so women?
It's a compilation of a number of different studies that each of us have done, sometimes independently and sometimes collaboratively. And early on, Sally and I worked on a focus group that we had where we put together groups of women of different cultural backgrounds and different age ranges. And so that was really, important in ensuring the diversity of the sample that we are using in our research. And then also we've used the internet in some, especially the study that Sally and I are collecting data on right now. We've used the internet and we ask for demographic information so that we're able to track the age, the cultural background, the socioeconomic level of the women that are responding to our survey.
One term that you used in the introduction, I did not quite understand. I mean, I sort of understood it in the context of the sentence, but I don't remember reading this before. You said that surveying women gave us certain kinds of information about their sense of agency personal power. Can you explain that a little further, what exactly is meant by a woman's sense of agency?
Right. And Deborah has really that has to do with, especially with some research that she's been really active in. And what that agency refers to is a woman's sense that she is empowered to act on her needs or her wishes or her plans, then the ability to accomplish those things that she wishes to accomplish and her feeling of empowerment to do so. And how much is anger... does anger contribute to that? And I think one of the more exciting things in the course of the last several years to come across, we We started out looking at how women divert anger because of the socialization and how women cope with the fact that they are angry and also with the rules that they feel that they have to play by in terms of not showing their anger. But we started to hear, and amongst all those stories of how women did that, we started to hear women telling stories about what happened when they really stayed with their anger and they got really furious. And we'd hear them say something like, you know, it was that night when I got so angry and I just couldn't stand it anymore and I really, really let it out. And in the middle of that, I realized, oh, my gosh, it just got so clear to me, this is what I need to do. And it was either, you know, I need to change my job or leave that boyfriend or stop drinking or whatever it was. I need to move back to whatever. And they get the sense of clarity around the issue that they were really angry about that had been eluding them before. And it was when they really stayed with their anger and tolerated that feeling and let it take them to the point of this realization that they felt, you know, was most powerful for them.
We're speaking with Karen Bruckner. She is one of the authors of a book entitled The Anger Advantage, The Surprising Benefits of Anger and How It Can Change a Woman's Life. Karen Bruckner is a psychotherapist who lives and works in the San Francisco Bay Area. Karen Bruckner, you say in the first chapter of the book that anger is a powerful and much misunderstood emotion. And you go on to say that, you know, what we really don't seem to have understood in the past but are beginning to explore now and understand better is that anger has a constructive, beneficial side. What is it that can be constructive or beneficial about anger?
Well, I think the fact that it has a lot of information to give us, and we can really learn a lot of important information about ourselves by attending to our anger and listening to it. Because anger is what happens when two people bump up against each other. It's at that point of conflict where people realize, you know, what I want is different from what you want. This is where I am different from you. You get a piece of information about who you are and what your preferences are, what you need, what you don't need. And it allows you to be in a relationship with someone who you may love very, very much, but still be able to be yourself and say, you know, even though I do love you and care about you, I really don't want to move to Boston, or I really don't want to have another child, or whatever the issue is. If you allow yourself, especially as a woman, if you allow yourself to feel that anger and acknowledge it, then you can hold on to that piece of information of who you are.
At some point early in the book, you also point to as a tangible benefit of anger, something I had not stopped to think about. Mm-hmm. You say that anger can help women, and I suppose it's true for men to some extent, help them to do many of the things they need and want to do, endowing their owner, the owner of the anger, with emotional energy and intellectual clarity for making needed life changes. I'd never stopped to think about anger being a positive source of energy.
Well, I think the other thing is that we do, especially in America, tend to mix anger with aggression very readily. And it's really important, I think, as a basis for the whole book and in our research, it's really important to differentiate those two things, that anger is an emotion and a feeling can be very constructive and does carry its own energy. Aggression is an energy, but it's a behavior. It's an acting out against someone, and we don't ever consider aggression to be helpful or positive. It can be very hurtful and harmful and unsafe. And so if you separate those two things and are very clear that I can be very angry and choose not to be aggressive, then you can take a look at what's positive about anger and what might be helpful to you.
This brings to mind one of the myths which you try to explore about anger, the fact that we often think that anger is inherently destructive.
Right.
And I guess that comes from that same confusion between anger and aggression.
Exactly. And how important it is to keep it clear. And I think, you know, what really struck me just lately, Michael Moore's film, Bowling for Columbine, in that film he tries to tease out the difference between Americans and other countries, especially Canada, where he makes the case that Canadians have just as many guns around as we do, and yet their murder rate is so much lower than ours. And I'm really, really curious about that. That just I've been so thoughtful and wondering if one of the pieces of that puzzle might be that in America, we tend to have this knee-jerk reaction and jump right from anger into aggression, whereas maybe in other cultures, you know, there's more of a separation there.
One of the things you say in terms of men and women sort of viewing and experiencing anger differently is traditional anger control programs miss the mark with most women.
Right.
How is that?
Well, I think many, many more women struggle with the problems of burying their anger than and hiding from it or avoiding it. Than the number of women who are struggling with dumping their anger on other people and needing to control their aggressive tendencies, although that certainly is a way that some women do deal with their anger. I think learning how to control your aggression is definitely, it's crucial. It is important. But again, it's just half the picture. The other half of the picture is what are you going to do with the anger that you're feeling? To try and talk yourself out of it or to say that if I just can live the right way and think the right way, I won't feel this anger, I think is really misleading for people. And I think especially for women, by trying to avoid the anger, they're also not having an opportunity to deal with the issues that cause the anger and that trigger the anger. So I think it would be much more helpful for women to find a way to explore the emotion, to experience the emotion, to learn that crucial information about what it is that's not right in their lives, and then be able to take some action so that the anger doesn't keep arising. I think that's much more helpful than trying to say, I don't need to be angry. Anger is negative and bad, so I'm going to calm myself down.
I especially appreciated the moment in the book when you bring up the, I think, undeniable fact that that anger and the way a given person deals with anger is not tied entirely to gender. Mm-hmm. Of course, it stems from all kinds of things. And you suggest that someone needs to examine their own personal anger archives to look at where life has taken them and all of the different ways in which maybe anger has been creative in their lives. How exactly is that beneficial or instructive for someone to do? And how would you suggest that somebody go about doing that examination of their anger archives, as you call it?
Right. I think it's reflective of the complexity of the whole issue, as we were talking about earlier, that it isn't a simple matter to take a look at where your anger has come from and not only what triggers your anger, but what are some of the rules that you learned growing up and as you became, that became part of your identity. What are some of the rules that you learned about how to deal with anger and how you feel about anger? So when we talk about anger archives, we're talking about women considering what role their family played in, you know, what did they learn about anger from their mothers and their grandmothers and their extended family? What were the rules about being angry when they were a little girl? And what kinds of things happened as they were growing up that caused anger for them? And was that anger stored? Is that anger ever resolved in any way? And the reason that's important is when as life goes on, there are going to be similar situations that mirror those kinds of incidents that happen in childhood. And you're going to get like an anniversary effect or it's going to be more of a hot trigger for someone, especially as women have their own children if they choose to do so. And these children get to be the same age as maybe the mother was when something that was very, what I call angergenic, happened to her. Or go through similar situations in school or with friends, with siblings. All these things are little bits of information and pieces of information that can really help you understand the meaning of anger in your life. And outside of family and growing up, there's religious influences and different cultural and socioeconomic influences. And so I think we have a few exercises and ideas in the book that help people try to make a start at looking at how all these things come together for them.
Is anger always a positive thing? Because, I mean, surely we are all aware of the fact that it's I mean, to coin the most common term, it's possible to be angry, to get angry in a way that doesn't really accomplish very much.
Right.
But in your view, when that begins to occur, then has anger turned into something else? Or do you prefer to discuss positive and negative ways of being angry or expressing anger?
Uh-huh. I think the latter is probably the most accurate, that definitely there are times when anger, if it's not directed at the person that needs to hear about it, when you start to communicate about your anger, then that can be a really negative experience and not as helpful as, just not as helpful. And I think also people can get stuck in their anger. If they, you know, we kind of break the process down into two stages. And the first stage involves developing an anger consciousness and an awareness. And for women, this is especially important because we talk about ways that they can get in touch with this emotion if they've been used to trying to avoid it or hide their anger. So that's the first stage. And then the second stage is communicating about it. And how are you going to talk about your anger to the person who needs to hear about it? And so sometimes people can get stuck in the first stage and just they're experiencing it, they're feeling it. It's very real to them, but they're having a hard time taking that next step to communicating and doing something about it. Or sometimes, you know, it can be the reverse where people are doing a lot of talking and venting, but perhaps they really aren't in touch with what the real issue is or what's happening inside them when they're angry so that their communication isn't as effective.
I was particularly intrigued by the list of 10 anger traps, which you encourage people to try and avoid. And I thought some of these were so helpful. For instance, the assumption that many people make that anger will go away on its own if you just give it enough time,
right.
Which really sounds good, but of course is not exactly true.
Right. I love those too. Those come directly from things that we hear women say in some of our interviews in our focus groups.
I wanted to also ask you about the process then where you encourage a woman to find their anger, find an angry voice, an angry face, an angry posture. What is helpful about that?
Well, I think in a lot of ways our bodies can help us access our emotions. If we're feeling cut off from our feelings, you know, our bodies can help us do that. And so we try to suggest a whole variety of different physical things that women can do, from what you just described about, you know, looking into a mirror and finding something that works for you in terms of, or that resonates with you, something that touches you emotionally and brings up some feelings. Everything from those kinds of exercises to ones that are really physically, involve a lot of physical exertion, whether it's a sports thing where you're kicking a soccer ball around or jogging or, you know, pounding on your couch cushions or ripping up old newspapers or something. It's really an effective technique to use to try to access your emotions through your physical body. And so that's really a lot of what those exercises are about. And also it's pretty, I think, grounding and in some ways empowering to either look at yourself in the mirror and see your face and see how you look or hear yourself, hear your voice, and see how you hear how you sound when you're angry, and realize that nobody is being mortally wounded. I've done exercises with women that involve a lot of physical activity, and to be able to do something that, as you know, maybe beat on a cushion or something as hard as you can for as long as you can, until you're really drained of that emotion, and you look around and you see that nobody's gotten hurt, you're not hurt, the world is still going on, that can be a big relief and a big revelation and very empowering.
As you mentioned earlier, one of the things that really probably makes your book distinct from many others is that you explore different arenas of a woman's life in which anger might be experienced and played out. Anger within one's spousal relationship, within friendships, within the family, in the workplace. Is it that anger is different in those different arenas, or that the causes are profoundly different? Why is it important, do you think, for us to be examining anger in this kind of way and to make these kind of distinctions?
Well, I think, again, it's relative to the complexity of the situation, which is something that we learn more about in listening to women and how they deal with anger in different ways, in different areas of their life. I think that when you are involved in relationships that have a power differential, such as at work, when you're dealing with anger towards your boss or when your boss is angry at you, or in the family when you are dealing with anger with your children, when that power differential is there, it makes a big difference in how you're going to express your anger and in how easy or comfortable it is for you to acknowledge the fact that you are angry at someone.
I find it interesting that in many of the specific guidelines that you give for women to more adequately and healthfully express their anger and work through it, that so often the L word comes up, listening. And it's interesting because I think for many of us, as we see ourselves angry in situations that make us angry, in some ways the last thing we feel like doing is listening carefully and honestly to the person on the other end of our anger. But you clearly believe that this is essential.
Right. And I think, yes, we do. We believe that it's really important. There's a couple of issues around that. There is a time when you don't want to have to attend to another person and another person's needs. And so that's why we try to separate the act of getting in touch with your own anger, where you don't have to worry about listening to someone else, but you can focus on yourself and what you're feeling. So we try to make sure that there is definitely a place and a space for women to do that. But when you move to the communication part of the process, which is just as important, listening is definitely a crucial part of that. And to be able to, it's funny that because for women, for anyone, it's difficult to listen when you're talking about painful topics, such as, you know, what's usually involved in an angry situation. But also, it's really hard for women to hear that other people are angry at them. I think it has to do with the idea that we feel very responsible as caretakers of the relationships that we're in. We're given a lot of responsibility for these relationships. And when somebody is angry at us, we feel like we've failed in some way or that the relationship is at risk. But really, if the anger is expressed in a respectful way, in an appropriate way, we're getting information. Just as when we share our anger with other people, we're trying to give information to them about our experience and what's important to us. The listening part, it's important to hear other people's anger in the same state of mind.
So what are the most important of the surprising benefits of anger that you mention in the subtitle of of the book? I mean, because I want to ask that very specifically, those benefits that indeed would surprise us that we wouldn't really stop to consider.
There are many. I think I would have to put at the top of the list the idea that to learn that you can love someone very much and still be angry at them. Because I think it's, again, a kind of a myth in our culture that if you're really angry with somebody, that means, you know, you're that somehow you can't love them at the same time. That's diminishing the love that you feel for them. And I think that's crucial because if you understand that and if you allow your anger to be part of a love relationship in whatever context, that means that you're able to bring your whole self into that relationship. So many times we're taught as women that we need to be attractive, we need to be appealing, we need to put other people's feelings first, and those are the things that we try to do when we love someone, we're in a relationship of love with someone. But if we decide to be honest about who we are and reveal the things that we're angry about, we are able to show all of ourselves to someone, and that relationship really becomes a lot deeper, a lot more intimate, a lot more honest and real. And I think that's been the most exciting and impactful finding that we've brought forward from the research, is that women really believe that anger is detrimental to a relationship. And what we're hearing from stories and what we're seeing with clients is that that's not the case. Relationships deepen and become more intimate when women feel that they're able to show all of themselves, including what they're angry about. Issues that trigger the anger get resolved, and women learn that the people that love them even though they're angry, or love them along with their anger. But, you know, it's that feeling that you're accepted for who you are, not for just the surface part of yourself or the attractive, appealing part of yourself.
I like how the image at the end of the book is that of a tapestry, that one's life, of course, is a complex tapestry with a great complex sort of texture to it and many different colors. And you say even within that one's own anger in itself is its own tapestry. And one should not be afraid of that, but should embrace it.
Exactly. I would. I feel like it's so important for women to listen to your anger and to learn from it, to not be afraid of it, to let go of the idea that if you're angry, you're crazy or you're PMSing or something like that. To let go of that and just be able to really accept your anger and listen to it and learn from it.
The book is The Anger Advantage, The Surprising Benefits of Anger and How It Can Change a Woman's Life, published by Broadway Books. Karen Bruckner, one of the authors. Karen Bruckner, it has been very interesting talking with you, and certainly was interesting reading the book. I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Greg. I really enjoyed being here.
The preceding morning show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2003. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program is a new interview recorded just last week. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with a gifted, in fact, award-winning author of fiction for both adults and young adults. And she labels her work far future galaxy spanning, mind-bending science fiction novels. And if that is intriguing to you, then you need to seek out her latest novel, a novel intended for young adult readers called The Library of Broken Worlds. And Alaya Dawn Johnson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So first of all, take us behind those intriguing words about how you like to frame your works as far future galaxy-spanning, mind-bending science fiction novels. It sounds like science fiction not as we maybe always think about it.
Yeah, you know, honestly, that's the kind of science fiction that I've always loved to read. Wonderful writers like Octavia Butler, Ursula Le Guin. I think we have this narrow idea nowadays that science fiction is only about technological innovation. But honestly, it's always also been about social insight and expanding our ideas of what is possible, imagining different futures. And that's something that I really wanted this time to bring to a young adult audience.
So tell us what you think about when you craft works with those particular readers or that particular sort of audience in mind.
Yeah, you know, for me, I have this inner 17-year-old that has never stopped wanting literature and works and stories that really kind of capture that experience. And what I really love about that moment in time is because it's when you're becoming an adult and when you first come face-to-face with the fact that, you know, the world is very complex and it has amazing beauty but also terrible injustice, and that a lot of things that you have been told about the world are not true at all or incredibly different. Or just much harder to get your head around. And I love that moment because I think you either decide to shut it down or you open up and you see so many more possibilities and so many more perspectives. And it's so important, I think, to be able to open up that imaginative space to young readers, especially marginalized young readers of color, like I was. And to me, like, opening up those spaces and being able to dignify that moment, like, really take it seriously is so important. So, I mean, to me, writing young adult just came very naturally, and I think it's a very important genre.
Wonderful. So I think a whole lot of people will be very much intrigued by the notion of a science fiction novel being set in, of all places, a library, not aboard a spaceship or a space station or on a vessel traveling between galaxies, but set in a library. So first of all, kind of talk about the whole notion of setting a novel like this in such a setting, and then what makes this library, of course, a bit different from the one we find down the street.
Yes, it's very, very different, and yet it shares the same beating core, which is it's a sanctuary. It's a repository of human knowledge, and it's a physical space, and it's also the resources, the way that it allows you to learn so much about the world. And to me, growing up, libraries, you know, for a lot of young people, libraries are sanctuaries. Library was where I went to be able to understand my world and understand that there were so many more worlds and so many other places, and just to have that breadth of understanding, of knowledge, of possibility. To me, that's what the library represents. And so when I was imagining, like, you know, 4,000 years in the future, there's these massive artificial intelligences that people consider to be material gods that have encompassed all of human knowledge, you know, even though that looks very different than a tower of books or a bunch of tunnels under the earth with, like, shelves of books, that's fundamentally still a library. So that's why I called it that. And the library of this world is a separate planet. It has its own solar system, and it's the material gods have built themselves. They've grown into the earth, and they have what the locals call arteries, you know, these tunnels built under the earth. That's like their physical space. And they're the ones that enforce peace among all of the people because they have incredible destructive power, but also this very nurturing power. And so that's how I ended up setting a science fiction novel in a library, because I kind of can't think of anything that's at once, you know, more powerful and more transformative than a library.
Right. At one point, this is said about the creation of this library, because when the universe would have drowned in blood, we built the library to save it. You and me, yes. Frida, who's really kind of the central character, we of the library preserve peace. Tell us more about how this library has served that function.
Yeah, this is a central theme of the book, and it's something that I really worked on in a lot of my rewrites for the 7 years to fully convey Freda's story. So The library is a repository for peace. It was created in the aftermath of a intergalactic war that killed billions of people and almost wiped out human civilization. And after that, the treaty that was formed made the library as a repository of peace. So all the material gods were kind of collected in this one place. That meant that they had kind of overwhelming destructive power. So there was a bit of like a hard stick of, you know, don't start anything because we can do the artificial intelligence equivalent of nuking you. Or, you know, but we have all of this knowledge. We have all of these perspectives. We invite scholars to come and study. So it's become an oasis, a kind of like a big university city. Was honestly one of like the big inspirations for me. And the peace that the library enforces is something that Freda at first really believes in, and then ends up understanding or seeing a different perspective and questioning it, because the real fundamental dichotomy there is what Dr. King called the peace of the absence of conflict versus the peace of the presence of justice, and what it means for peace to exist when some people have never known peace.
Hmm. Tell us more about this character. I think you pronounced her name Freda.
Yes.
Tell us more about what makes her tick and how you constructed her.
Yeah. So Freda is an interesting character in that she is very much of the library and also in between worlds and not fully accepted. So she was born in the tunnels of the arteries of these library gods. She was created by this AI, but she looks like a human. She has human genes, and but people consider her to be kind of questionable humanity. Is she a thing? Is she an object? Is she really a person? What kind of rights does she have? And she's grown up in this kind of limbo as an insider outsider. And she, her parent is the head of the library, so a person who's very powerful. Nevertheless, Freda herself is kind of someone with a great deal of privilege and none at all. And so when she ends up meeting two very much outsiders from marginalized communities, people who are victims of the library's peace and who are living in the midst of extreme conflict, of their homes being in danger, of being taken away from them, of their religion being persecuted into non-existence, that's when she starts to have kind of her eyes opened to the fact that it's not just her who's been rejected or marginalized by this system of peace. It's also many, many other people who in different parts of the universe. And I think that was, like I said, that moment of being 17 and kind of understanding suddenly all of the different lives and the different ways that the world works that you didn't really understand. Like that's her moment of that. And then, you know, the story changes with her own kind of internal changes.
Right. And of course, part of what is a hallmark of the story are a couple of really important friendships that I think the way you write those and in a sense give them life in the book feel very, very authentic. Tell us quickly about these friendships that figure so prominently in the story and in Freda's life journey here.
Oh yeah, thank you so much for that question. I love stories about friends. I love, because they're so important to me in my life. And as you know, the friendships I had when I was 17 are friendships that I still treasure and maintain now. And I think a lot of people have that experience. And the friends that Freda has, she has, you know, friends and lovers, Joshua and Ergui, the two characters I was talking about before. There's also a Timpa who is kind of a rival and a friend at the same time. And the way that they negotiate their insider-outsiderness, because I think all of the characters have a certain element of that struggle. You know, they are very different characters, but you can really feel the love between them. And that was just something that it took, again, a couple of rewrites to get right. But when it really hit, I was so excited because I felt like a friendship that I treasure. It felt like something that I had also experienced. And I think often, especially female friendships, are not underdeveloped or always rendered as kind of competitive. And I wanted to be able to depict a relationship that was at once competitive, but also deeply loving and true.
Mm.
So So, yeah, I mean, that was very much like the attempt of Fredo relationship.
Well, I think you managed that very well. And I know it took you 7 long years from the outset to finally finish this, but I'm so glad you did. It's a wonderful novel, again, called The Library of Broken Worlds, published by Scholastic. And the author is Aliyah Dawn Johnson. Aliyah Dawn Johnson, congratulations and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.